and welcome to this podcast run by the Oxford Society for International Development. My name is Helena and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak today with Diana Fox-Carney, an Oxford alumna and leading expert in climate policy and overseas development with a wealth of experience to her name. We will be discussing a broad range of subjects, both career-related and tackling some of the great challenges in the development sector. But first, I think it would be best if we begin with a short introduction to yourself and your background, Diana.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here and glad to share my wisdom to the extent that I have any. I attended Oxford. I was at Keble as an undergrad. I did PPE. Is it matriculation? Yes, I started in 1984. So I'm quite old, 84 to 87 at Oxford doing PPE. I then went to the University of Pennsylvania. I had a Turon scholarship and studied international relations there as a master's. Following that, I came back to the UK and I was a management consultant for MySins for about 18 months. I didn't quite last 2 years and switched out of that. And we can talk about that experience and what I learned and why I moved. Initially went to the BBC in strategic planning, but very swiftly moved to do a stage and internship at the European Commission. And I was lucky enough to fall in the development directorate there. And that's really what set me off on my career in international development. So I was there for a little while. I figured out I needed a sort of more directed master's and I came back to Oxford and did a master's in agricultural economics. At that time sponsored by what is now called FCDO, I believe, and previously was DFID, and previously when I was there was the Overseas Development Administration. So they put me through my master's, and then I went off to Zanzibar to work on an agricultural development project, and subsequently worked at the Overseas Development Institute in London and did a variety of freelance work and then latterly moved more into climate work, but we can get there in the end. But yeah, so I'm a double Oxford degrees and checkered career in between.
Wow, that is quite an impressive list of achievement. To kind of start at the beginning, perhaps you've touched upon it, but it'd be interesting to know what drew you into a more the development world and away from perhaps a more conventional career path.
Yeah, I think the important thing to say is that when I was at Oxford, despite the ample careers advice, overseas development wasn't really on anyone's horizon at that time, which seems a little odd looking back from where we are now. But nobody I knew went into the space. And when I did go into the space, I discovered that very many of the people were in it, had some kind of connection. Either their parents had been in it, they were sort of colonial, as it were, their parents had lived in Kenya or what, or a country like that. So it was more normal to them to be in that space. Whereas for people that certainly that I knew and certainly my, you know, people I still know from those days, I was quite an outlier. I think in the first iteration of leaving Oxford, it never even crossed my mind that this would be a viable career option. And I was swept into the kind of conventional banking consulting thing that goes on. However, I didn't much like the business. I didn't feel there was any great purpose to augmenting the profits of random corporations for which I was working as a management consultant. I did learn a huge amount, and I wouldn't say that that's a bad career path for anyone. Just for me, it didn't really touch my soul if I was going to put in long hours to help someone else make money. Didn't really kind of do it for me. But also, to be honest, I was just very excited by overseas travel, and I actually grew up near Oxford, but I hadn't traveled as a kid. I interrailed after my A-levels, but I was desperate to travel. And the idea that one could combine a career with the possibility of really traveling, but living overseas, was supremely exciting to me at the time. So that is what took me into development.
Great. You briefly touched upon kind of my next question, but I'd be interested to know what you think has changed in the past decade or two in the development sector and what you think might change in the coming years.
So what's funny about development is it's a bit cyclical, and issues kind of come and go. And a lot is obviously dictated by how much money is flowing into the sector at the time. Right now we're staring in the face really large cuts in UK spending in the space, which will affect things, not only direct spending, but spending through NGOs and other organizations. On the other hand, there's new more private sector opportunities, I think, emerging. When I started in development, it was a very traditional model. We had projects. So the UK government, I worked on a project. So they sent out, you know, five of us, and we went to a place and we kind of dug holes in the soil and set up an essential oil test factory and looked for crops and worked with the ministry. But it was very, very led by us as expatriates, which was, you know, uncomfortable in some ways, but we, you know, we did support our colleagues, our what were called counterparts in the ministry, but it was a traditional model. There was then a movement towards much more greater budgetary support and support to different ministries, so they had a greater say. But that meant that the UK moved out of providing expertise, so there was many more people sort of working in headquarters and channeling the money through to other people, whether it was through the multilateral development banks or other people. So the kind of on the ground, send out a 25-year-old to you know, experiment with crops and things. I mean, I speak from the agricultural side because that's where I started. I grew up on a farm, so it made sense to me to start that way. But and then it changed, and then the move, you know, there was a move to funding a lot more government money through NGOs. So again, these things change. So there's sort of phases that you can trace through. But there's also been a really important shift to supporting in-country people to solve their own problems, which that should be the way we go about working with people. I mean, there is a shortage of money. That's the problem. We do have money and they often don't have money. So they do need our resources, but it's not clear that they need someone like me going out at the age of 28, thinking that they know better or can teach something or whatever it might be. And I think that was an awkward thing when I was first out in the world, because I'd been selected for my sort of intellectual capabilities and my Western type abilities, but those weren't necessarily the skills that were required when I got to my job in Zanzibar, where I first worked. So I soon realized that I was probably not well suited to actually working in the field. And then I luckily worked in development policy, and which I think I was better suited to. And I've seen, you know, the shifts in that side too. So really the relative focus on, for example, supporting the private sector development, the relative focus on poverty alleviation as a critical aspect, and now the focus on climate, which is, I hope, a direction that will be pursued going forward.
Great. That's a very interesting perspective, and one that I think comes up quite a lot. For those of us who are interested in development but belong to a kind of Oxford community that seems quite distant from some of those areas that we are looking at and talking about. And I know that international development certainly can have a reputation for its savior mentality and for potentially causing more harm than good. Some people argue that those who are not directly part of the community shouldn't get involved at all, and perhaps you have some advice for those of us at Oxford who perhaps feel a bit distant from the environment and are conscious of this reputation in how best to get involved and how to really support and have a positive impact?
I think it's an enormously difficult question. I mean, we are very fortunate because we have access to great education, we live in wealthy societies, and I think it's great that some amongst us, you know, hopefully many amongst us, want to help, give back, share, as it were. But you're absolutely right that that sort of savior mentality is inappropriate. I mean, there needs to be a kind of humbleness about what we can do. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, in large part, it is our money, it is our resources that are going to be of greatest use. And I think that you have to think carefully about human capital and how you can help. Now, I'm not saying that there are no opportunities to help, there absolutely are, but I mean, some of the jobs that make sense to do are for sure in, for example, multilateral development banks and places where you're working with colleagues from developing countries from a range of different countries as colleagues, and you can understand cultures and get into things, but there are also sort of critical roles. And I think there is a lot more that the multilateral development banks can do, certainly in the climate space. So you think about the climate emergency and development clearly come together. And, you know, for me, I moved a little bit out of development for a couple of reasons. One was I had kids, and it's not easy to travel when you have kids. That was the practical side. But, you know, more profoundly, I realized that, you know, me going and trying to stick a little band-aid on some problem in Africa when ultimately it was climate change that was the problem for many people. Once you're living in a fragile environment, you really have no capacity to live with changing climate. So I decided that the best thing I could do with my kind of human and other capital would be to try and work in my home country and try and focus on climate solutions. So I think there are different ways you could work, you know, in and with developing countries now. And I do think increasingly there are private sector opportunities to work with, they are private sector, but they may be more kind of social business opportunities to work with people, to support people. And honestly, like, fundraising, it's not very exciting. I've never done it. I'm a terrible fundraiser, but it's important. It's important for NGOs and others here. And then the last space that is difficult, because it is the savior space, is the emergency space. And, you know, I think the on a purely humanitarian level, we will always have to provide emergency help to people. Now, yes, we should try and eliminate the problems at source, but with climate problems becoming increasingly common, we're going to have more emergencies, not fewer emergencies. And working, you know, even in logistical capacities and really helping those systems to run effectively is incredibly important, even if it can seem a little bit challenging because it's sort of repeated emergencies. And when I was younger, there was a lot of talk about the development, emergency development continuum, and how you can kind of work on development to avoid the emergencies. Well, that's kind of true, but with all these increasing climate issues, it's pretty hard to imagine that you could actually generate enough resilience in these communities to prevent an emergency being an emergency, if you see what I mean. So I think that we have to accept that we will always have emergencies, and that's a valid place to put one's time, but also extremely demanding and not always an easy place to work.
Sure, I think the increasing awareness about the climate issues and how that relates to all of these other challenges is hopefully a positive thing, in that it's becoming more of a conversation, but also definitely challenging. How do you consider the apparent trade-off between such different sustainability goals as alleviating poverty and climate mitigation, which sometimes appear to be competing, and how has your experience maybe shaped this view?
So I first traveled to China when I was in my year off, so before Oxford, and subsequently I've been back a couple of times for work. But what immediately struck me there was the trade-off between, you know, raising the population up and, you know, just decimating the countryside, the kind of, you know, flying pieces of thin film plastic for the crops, the sort of every corner is tilled and the soils look as though they're about to all float away, etc. And that was before we got the really big air quality issues. So it became very apparent to me that there can be an enormous trade-off. And if we, you know, discount the environment for the sake of early poverty gains, that there's going to be problems down the line. Incidentally, I did my master's thesis on discounting the environment, on discount rates for environmental cost benefit analysis. So that, but that was subsequent to my visit to my first visit to China. Anyway, when working in overseas development and working with people in different communities, I think, you know, the interesting thing is at one level, people, you know, indigenous people and local people are the best custodians of their local environment, if they also had the luxury to be the best custodians of their environment. The problem is that they often don't really have that choice. So, and I think this is most apparent with the use of the burning of charcoal and wood in Africa and everywhere, and the kind of decimation of trees and landscapes, and the difficulty, honestly, the enormous difficulty of shifting people to more sustainable cook stoves, which is, it's really an unsolved problem, despite lots of NGOs and businesses working in that space. And I'm involved with some, you know, organizations that support people in that space, and it's enormously difficult. So you have a situation where, because of how fragile people's lives are, you know, they don't really have the luxury of tending to stuff well, even though obviously they're damaging themselves in the long term. And this is, you know, something has to give in this space, basically. There have to be solutions. I mean, there are solutions, but to get adoption of those solutions is always harder than you think. So, you know, obviously there are win-win situations, and there are instances where local people can be kind of brought in and rewarded in some way. They can work in sort of ecotourism settings. They can, you know, even, you know, now we have people being paid for ecosystem services and carbon sequestration in different capacities. But it's not easy, and there's a lot of we have to change cultural norms sometimes, and find really big solutions in that space is difficult. It's quite easy to imagine sort of small, a nice eco, very expensive environmental lodge where people have good jobs, and it's all fine, but that's not really going to solve the problem of, you know, Africa as a whole, or any given country, or whatever it might be.
Yeah, certainly a challenge for us as future generations, I'm sure. And kind of building on that, do you believe that one particular sector, whether public, private, or third sector NGO, is the most effective at achieving some of these goals, or whether maybe there's perhaps a combination involved?
So it probably won't surprise you to know that my answer to that is, you know, partnerships are important. That's the easy answer. I mean, I started my life working for the British government. I then moved to working for a think tank, and worked with a variety of foundations and other people funding in the space. I have sat on the board of major NGOs and work with them in a sort of policy capacity, but I sat on the board of Save the Children in the UK and saw their endeavors in this space. And I now sit on the board of the Shell Foundation, which puts about $40 million dollars a year into business, effectively local business that endeavors to have an enterprise-based solution to problems of energy access, carbon reduction, and transportation. So the answer is I've sort of seen all the different approaches. And I do think that even I'd like to say that you could find really good private sector solutions, but unfortunately, I don't fully believe that. I do think that it's important. I think to get to scale, you either have to work with kind of the market that's going to take it to scale or big governments. And the problem with NGO type activities, if they're small scale and they're very local, they're fine, but they're not big enough basically to solve problems. The private sector can do really, really well, but you're working in spaces in Africa and other places that just isn't enough money to sustain private sector business. So, you know, if you're trying to bring energy to people, and even if you're able to offer them you know, a solar energy package in their home for under $1 a day, I mean, they can't afford it. And we have to recognize that in our own countries, energy in many times has been subsidized, basically. We haven't paid the full cost of these things. And we probably need ongoing subsidy to the poorest parts of the population if they're going to be able to have access to energy. And without access to energy, for example, they're very unlikely to be able to sort of climb up the income ladder and reduce their vulnerability. So I think it's great that we are able to use private sector solutions, and I'm positive about it, but I also think that we need to recognize the limitations of that. And if we focus unduly on private sector, we'll have a tendency to leave the bottom of the pyramid behind. And that's what worries me a little bit when, you know, government agencies really, really focus on the private sector, is that they get sort of almost carried away and don't recognize that there are people who just, you know, you're never going to be able to make money out of these people, and therefore they're not an attractive market for private sector solutions. So, but I do think that everyone working in parallel, working together, can provide a more effective solution to people. So, you know, it's, there's a place for everyone. And I do think, you know, in the emergency space, I think that government and NGO works. Obviously, that's not a private sector, or I don't believe really should be a private sector space. And so, you know, it's kind of horses for courses, but it's seldom the case that one type of organization on its own really can crack the nut that has to be cracked, I would say.
Sure. Turning perhaps more towards some questions about careers, what advice do you have for Oxford students thinking about entering into the sector?
It's a tough one because of this issue that you kind of need experience to get jobs, but you can't get experience, and it's a sort of vicious slightly exclusionary circle that can present itself to people. But I do think that, I actually think that the importance of, you know, gaining generic skills is still there. So as I said, I didn't enjoy being a management consultant. However, I learned a huge amount from being a management consultant that I have applied later on in life. So, you know, my theory on jobs is like, there's something to learn in every job. I mean, you obviously want to kind of broadly target something you think you might like, but learning more and applying it is helpful. I think spending time, I mean, if possible, spending time in countries. So even if you're not explicitly sort of working in your chosen area, I think if you can get overseas exposure and just, you know, the understanding of how different things are culturally in different places, and how kind of work just functions in a different way in different places is enormously helpful. So for, you know, then if you are working with people from those cultures, you know, you'll have a greater openness and a greater sense of or hopefully a greater ability not to sort of project your cultural norms. And I found this enormously difficult when I went to Africa, because it used to annoy me enormously that people didn't show up to work, for example, when it was raining. And I just couldn't understand this. And, you know, gradually over time, I came to realize that it sort of didn't matter that much. And if you got really, really wet, it was really, really hard to get really dry afterwards. And so there was kind of an absolute reason why you might not want to go to work when it was raining and stuff. But this is not something that, you know, we would countenance here. So just kind of understanding how work fits into people's lives, et cetera. You know, obviously you have to kind of be in place to understand some of these things. And, you know, I do think that supporting organizations that work to highlight, you know, the conditions in these countries and try and, you know, whether it's organizations like Amnesty or Transparency International and people, so you can use your skills to kind of do research, do analysis, help out, you know, and get involved in countries, even if you're not instantly kind of relocating and doing something in a developing country. And I think we do need to be humble about what we can contribute. And we do need to recognize that often we're gaining more than they're gaining when we go to places. So, you know, this is the sort of issue around adventure tourism and going to build a school in Kenya in your summer holidays. I mean, it's great, but it's for you. It's not really for them. You have to recognize that. It's not that it's not valuable. It's really good to go to those places. It's really important to see the way people live and to understand how different it is. And in some ways to understand how similar it is, how, you know, for example, the mobile phone is, you know, has permeated everywhere and is the way people live kind of globally, yet, you know, there are lots of things they have, lots of things we don't have. And so it's really valuable to learn those things, but I think you do have to be humble and you know, you're not doing them a favor, you're doing yourself a favor by learning those things. So, I mean, I wish I could say there were sort of, you know, really obvious routes. Obviously, you know, some of the, I mentioned the multilateral development banks, other things, you know, these are tough, you know, they do have young professional programs, they do have things, but they're tough to get into. And I guess I would just finally say that being creative, I mean, people that obviously move around careers a lot more now and, you know, but being creative, sort of sidelight, you know, moonlight, you know, doing one job in the day and kind of moonlighting on another thing in the evening, you know, getting involved where you can, volunteering for charities, this kind of thing can kind of help get you in place so that when opportunities come up, you'll be ready to take them, recognizing that, you know, some, as I say, lots of skills are transferable, some aren't.
Thank you, that's really helpful. And a kind of another question that I think a lot of people have is whether to go down the route of really specializing and gaining very specific skills that then put them in a good place for a niche perhaps, or whether it's better to stay broad and really gain as many different experiences as possible. I wonder if you have any insight into that.
So that's a fantastic question. I think as a PPEist, which I think you are you? Yes. I mean, I think we're inherently kind of broad people, right? We do a bunch of stuff. And, you know, one of my strengths in life, I would say, is that I'm interested in really a lot of things. And I'm interested in finding intersections between things that aren't necessarily thought of in the same bucket. And I've always been broad, and I like that. However, I have always slightly looked, you know, the grass has always seemed a bit greener on the other side, and I've always kind of wanted to be the expert on something, and I've never been the expert particularly because I've always stayed broad. I would say, and at various times in my life, I have considered going deep and doing a PhD and then realized that I just didn't want to spend another 3 years going really, you know, it's not my personality to sort of dig really deep on something. And so I think you can obviously go at it either way. I mean, I lean towards general being a generalist, probably in a very self-serving way, because I am, but you could, I think at my ripe age, you can be a generalist and an expert, you know, but only because I've done it for so long that actually I do know quite a lot about things, if you see what I mean. So it's not that I really narrowly focused on one thing, but actually I've accumulated quite a lot of wisdom in one space, so that I can be both, but I would hate to not have a broad view. So as I said, I've worked with, you know, a variety of different organizations. I feel like I can speak to people from a variety of different constituencies, whether it's sort of business, finance, think tanks, academia, anything, government, and I'm able to kind of be a good interlocutor between them because I've worked in all the different spaces or had contact with all the different people, and I can kind of help interpret them to each other, if you see what I mean. So I think that that level of being a generalist, being able to not so much network but develop relationships with people across a range of things and look for opportunities to sort of find connections and find synergies and opportunities between the traditional kind of buckets of who does what, I think can be helpful. But as I say, if you've got the personality to be a deep specialist, there's also, you know, we need deep specialists, and, you know, I would love to be a sort of plant geneticist in some part of my brain. I just know I couldn't do it.
Well, thank you for that. And with that, I think I will wrap up this conversation just by thanking you for giving us your time. I'm sure I'm not the only one who has very much appreciated everything you have shared with us. And really, really benefited from your insight into some of these issues. So thank you.
Well, thanks for having me. Thanks for letting me share. I think, you know, in everything, there's a lot of serendipity in life, and, you know, there's certainly no one pathway, but I am thrilled that there is an overseas development, sort of, you know, society at Oxford, and that people are really engaged now with these issues of doing good, you know, and doing well, and really trying to make the world a better place at a pretty challenging time. So thanks for having me.